welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Artie Clark, who is the author of Untold Stories of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica, about the Sky People. Dr. Clark set out on a 7-year adventure from 2003 to 2010 through Belize, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico, and she collected stories of UFOs, sky gods, giants, aliens, and other stories among the indigenous people, and has written a book about these stories. And what's interesting is that these stories are interwoven with the cultures that she had visited. And I think more than anything for me, it makes us understand that these visitations are very, very common, and probably even more common among certain areas of the world than they may be, say, in Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Clark is a professor emeritus at Montana State University and director of the Center for Bilingual Multicultural Education. And her first book was Encounters with Star People. And we're very pleased to have her as a guest today. Welcome, Dr. Clark. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I guess if you'll give our listening audience a little bit about your background and how you were introduced to the concept of UFOs and how you became interested in the study of this.
Well, as a child, I'd heard stories of the star people, and like all people, I guess, you know, you put the stories of your childhood behind you, and you go to high school, and you graduate from college and get a job. And when I was first came to Montana State University as a faculty member, I had one of my jobs, I was the director of the Center for Bilingual Multicultural Education, and this center served 26 tribal groups in the Northern Plains region. And I would go out and introduce myself to the different tribes and recruit students to come to Montana State to study teacher education or to be principals and administrators of reservation school districts, because at that time there were very few Native people working in the schools. And on my first trip out into the field, I met a young man who organized the meeting with potential students. And after the meeting was over, we went out to dinner in a neighboring town. And on the way back through his reservation, he said, "If you got a few minutes, I'd like to show you something." And he took me up in the mountains above his village and parked the car and sat on a boulder, and he said, "If we're lucky, they'll come." And I really sat there and listened to him tell me stories about the star people and the ancient legends of his people. And on my way back to the university, I kept thinking, how many other tribal groups have similar stories? And so that began my journey into investigating ancient legends as well as contemporary stories. It led into contemporary stories of UFO encounters and the star people. And so that's what set me on my journey. But my interest in Central America came about much earlier when I was a high school student. A teacher handed me a book called Incidents of Travel in Central America, the Chiapas and the Yucatan. And it was a story of two 19th century explorers by the name of John L. Stevens and Frederick Catherwood. And these two explorers had gone to Mesoamerica. The first trip they made was in 1839. because they had heard rumors of these ancient cities in the jungle. And at that time, no one believed they really existed. In fact, his colleagues thought it was ridiculous that they were making this trip. And, but they persevered and landed in Belize, Belize City. At that time, it was part of British Honduras. And, proceeded to travel through Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico in search of these ancient cities. On their first trip, when they arrived in Palenque, Mexico, the mosquitoes and the conditions were so bad that Catherwood became very ill with malaria. And finally, they had to, they got him out of there and got him to the Yucatan, to a hacienda near Uxmal, which was another ancient city. But Catherwood was so ill that they took him back to, Stevens got him back to New York City. And in 1841, they made their second trip. And that resulted in a book called Incidents of Travel in the Yucatan. And this trip, they only traveled to Mexico. Well, after I read those books, I told my teacher, I said, you know, one day I'm going to follow in their footsteps.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, it will be quite a journey. And that's what I always planned to do. And, of course, life interfered with that plan.
Mm-hmm.
And when I retired at Montana State, I decided I was going to fulfill that dream. And along the way, I had read stories of the ancient astronauts and how they were the ones responsible for the cities and that the Maya couldn't have possibly been responsible. So when I set out on the journey, I decided that I would investigate. I would follow in Stevens and Catherwood's footsteps, but I would also investigate that theory. And along with it, I would look for the ancient stories and for contemporary stories. So that's how this book came about.
It seems to me that there's a couple of conditions in the areas that you visited that are very different from, say, most parts of the United States. The different tribal groups have an oral history that we just simply don't have here because we're not telling stories to our children, except maybe, fairy tale stories, but nothing, indigenous to, say, Atlanta. We don't have Atlanta stories that we tell, that we pass down. And then the other thing is that, which I found interesting was, that one of the people in your book thought that when they first saw the UFO that it was the American military.
Uh-huh.
You know, that the way they were dressed, the uniforms and the technology made them think it might be the American military. And we really do have a lot of military bases with a lot of ability to get fighter jets up in the air to investigate. And so the whole of United States is probably a lot more difficult to enter for UFOs. Now, I know there are a lot of UFO activity in the U.S., but I would think it would be easier in the areas that you visited for UFOs to come and go without, inciting the investigation of the military.
Well, a couple of responses. I think that at one time all people had oral stories. But as the Enlightenment came along, those oral stories were put aside and everything was, based on science. And if you couldn't prove it, it wasn't worth talking about. Or it
right,
was simply
yeah.
relegated to fantasy.
Right.
The interesting thing about it is Native American tribal groups have maintained that oral history, even in the United States. And it's a very strong part of the upbringing of children. All of the, you know, I mean, I hear dozens and dozens of stories out here among the Native American tribal groups, and the oral history is alive and well among the people here. And I think that's really important, and I know that my nieces and nephews are continuing to upbringing of their children are hearing these ancient stories as well. So the Native Americans, I think, in the United States still maintain that oral history. But perhaps on an even keel, if not more so, than what I found in Mesoamerica. But the interesting thing about many of the stories in Mesoamerica is that they do take a different color, in that many of them are more supernatural in nature than the stories that are told by American Indians.
Right. So, you know, perhaps they have more visitations, you know, just more opportunity for these stories to, you know, to be remembered.
I'm not so, you know, you know, my first book called Encounters with Star People, which was The Untold Stories of American Indians, you know, it's strictly dealt with American Indians in the 48 states and Alaska. And so I'm not, you know, there's a lot of visitation going on among American Indians and Native Americans and Star People. So I don't know that it's less here than it is in Mesoamerica, but it certainly does exist in both places. And I'm sorry, my voice is rather hoarse. I'm just really suffering from sinus problems.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't get an opportunity to read your first book, but it would seem that the people that are open to the visitations and have I guess less preconceived notions about them, do you think that that is who the groups that have more visitations? Now I know that, I mean, I do know that UFO visitations, abductions, are there are probably millions of people in America who have experienced something with UFOs, maybe not full abductions, but at least sightings of UFOs. I mean, I know it's very, very common, but it's not common within our society to talk about them. You know, it's still quite, people keep secrets about it. They are afraid of being, you know, thought less of by their peers, or, as you pointed out in the book, the Christian missionaries would say it was of the devil. Do you think it's some of the belief systems we have here in America, where the Bible Belt Christianity beliefs, that cause people to keep these to themselves?
Well, I think it's a number of reasons. And I'm not so sure that in America that it is the influence of Christianity as much as it is in Mesoamerica. I think in Mesoamerica, you know, the Catholic faith is extremely strong, but inroads have been made into into the church there by the evangelical religion. Coming into that part of the world by the Mormons and by the Jehovah's Witnesses. I visited one community in Mexico, for example. The name of the town is the 20th of November. I went there in search of someone who could take me to this site that I had heard about, that they said that it's almost impossible to get there, that it was very difficult. And so I went to this community the 20th of November looking for someone who might be able to lead me there. And I met a young beekeeper who not only took me there, but who explained to me all the problems he was having with his bees by the invasion of these really aggressive bees that were destroying his hives. And the village he lived in probably had between 40 and 100 people. And I was probably stretching it to even say there were 100 people. There were no more than a dozen houses in his village. But there was a Catholic church, a Church of God, a Mormon center, and a Jehovah Witness center.
Oh, my goodness.
All to serve this small little village. And I asked him about that, and he said, well, you know, 10 people go to this one, and 12 go to this one. And I was just amazed.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, the war that was going on there for souls in this little town. And I found that in a lot of places throughout that part of the world. I ran onto places where people had left the Catholic Church and were never let back into their community again. Because they had, and this was the ruling of political leaders, not the church leaders. So I think that religion plays a much greater role in that part of the world in reporting UFOs than it does in the United States.
Oh, yeah. Well, it also is interesting that the Pope, as well as some of the other branches of the Catholic Church, have made it clear that the Catholic religion does not rule out the existence of aliens.
Absolutely.
Or extraterrestrials. And, you know, it just occurred to me that it may be because so much of the Catholic Church is Spanish-speaking and, you know, is maybe experiencing a lot more visitations and phenomena than, say, the Catholics in, you know, maybe in Atlanta, Georgia.
Well, you know, and they also, the Catholics have that that huge observatory on Mount Graham down in Arizona.
Right.
And, you know, and they study the universe, you know, 24/7, from what I understand.
Well,
and
I have a feeling that the things that occurred at in Yugoslavia, you know, the secrets that were revealed to the children have a lot to do with what's coming and involve extraterrestrials. I'm almost positive that the secrets of, I can't remember the name of it, but when Mother Mary appeared, that probably some of the things that are going to be forthcoming involve extraterrestrials. And I think they're just getting ready for this. I mean, I think that they were told some of the future events that are going to be coming. So the Catholic Church was the position. Yeah, it was in Yugoslavia. Mother Mary appeared before children and educated them.
Are you sure you're not talking about Fatima?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that was in Portugal.
Oh, I'm sorry. Portugal.
Yeah, that was in Portugal.
Yeah.
I've actually been there to that site.
Have you?
Yes. And,
yeah.
If you can imagine it's regarded as such a sacred site. And the dedication of the people, it's just absolutely amazing the spirituality involved there. And I found that throughout, you know, Central America, there's that whole idea that life is so bad here on Earth that, you know, it's going to be better, you know, when you die. mm-hmm. and that, you know, you're gonna live in this in a world that is gonna be free of pain and hardship and all that. And that really carries through. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I believe religion has such an appeal to poor people.
Yes.
You know, because you've got that belief that, you know, if you suffer here, you will not suffer after, you know, you go to heaven. And I, you know, I don't have a reason to criticize that because, I talked to a Catholic priest who actually saw a UFO, when he was a child, if you remember the story of how, mm-hmm. you know, he told the alien that he would remember the event, and the alien said, well,
right.
No, you won't remember. And he took the rock home with him and placed it by his sandals and said,
yeah.
Now, if I get up in the morning and that rock is there, I'll know I didn't dream this.
That's right. Well, and, you know, people who are more spiritually evolved, and I'm sure the priest was, have an ability to remember despite the hypnosis or whatever
well,
it is
you know,
that they
I
use.
Had one person tell me that, you know, he had repeatedly been abducted, and he got to know his abductors and communicate with them. And one of the things that mm-hmm. they told him was that many people report, for example, that when you go on board, when you're taken on board these ships, there's a different atmosphere. It's a misty atmosphere almost that seems to seep into the environment where you are. Well, he told mm-hmm. me that he was told that the mist in the air is actually some kind of a chemical that is used to make people forget and to mm-hmm. make them lethargic and put them into a non-aggressive mode.
Right.
But the aliens have told him that there's a percentage of people that it doesn't work. So
right.
there are humans that this chemical doesn't work on. But they told him they didn't worry about that percentage because even if they told their story, no one would believe them anyway.
Exactly, yeah. That's
and
true.
So I think that's the thing that, you know, if you had 100% of the people reporting it, that would be something mm-hmm. different. But when only a small percentage of them remember, then they don't worry about that small percentage.
Right. Well, the U.S. government has done a pretty good job of, you know, making sure that if you're talking about aliens, people start wondering if you should be visiting a psychiatrist. So, you know,
well,
that platform is very, very strong in the U.S. And that keeps people from talking about things for the most part, but not always. You and I are on air talking to probably about 3,000 people with this, so. So there are people who are interested, and you know, I think that it's having interviewed so many different people on this topic, including ex-military and people who were working side by side by the aliens, and people who have collected stories from thousands of people. Personal stories. I don't think we can ignore the phenomena, but I think it's. I really liked your book because these people are a lot more, I would say, innocent and a lot more. They're not as jaded by public opinion, and they're
well,
a
they
lot more forthcoming.
Exposed. You know, like Americans are, so many of us, unless you do live in remote areas or places like Montana.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have access to all the things that other people have. You know, they don't get a lot of movies on UFOs. They don't get the History Channel and all those things that, you know, the
right.
alien shows that are on TV. So
yeah.
they don't have that exposure. they don't have that exposure to books, to movies, to documentaries, any of that kind mm-hmm. of thing. And so their stories, you know, are as you say, quite innocent. Even mm-hmm. in their descriptions of things that happened to them, they relate the tube-shaped alien ship as like a gasoline tank, which I thought
yeah,
was,
right.
You know, they don't have the preconceived ideas. And mm-hmm. so that it is a unique offering of UFO stories because the people haven't had that exposure. And that was something that was really quite interesting as I, you know, did my interviews.
So some of the stories that you have in your book have particular the side effects that can occur after these abductions. The one that where they became sick and they said that the aliens were poisoned. Would you like
right.
to talk about that story a little bit? Because I thought that was interesting. It does correlate with some of the other things that have been said about other alien abductions here in the U.S.
Well, it was a story he said that people should know that when they encounter these aliens that they're poison, and I asked him to tell me what he was talking about, and he said that they were in a cornfield. They were working their cornfield and they noticed a strange object appear at tree level.
Mm-hmm.
And it was coming straight down, breaking limbs and trees. And it said the object never sat down on the ground, but it hung in the air above the ground. And mm-hmm. He described it as two plates turned upside down and stuck together. And he said a strange little man came out of the object and floated to the ground. And then he walked very stiff with short steps. He said, I thought he must be a demon. So there is the mm-hmm. that religious connotation.
Right.
And he said he wore a one-piece brown suit, and his hands were covered, and his shoes were part of the suit, he said. And I said, well, did the strange man see you? And he said, well, not at first. He said he walked into our cornfield, and he started checking the ears, and he took some of them. And he said... I said, well, what did you think when you saw him taking samples of your corn? And he said, well, I didn't understand what he was doing. I said, well, did he communicate with you in any way? He said, no, I don't think he saw us. But he said, my brother jumped up and tried to steer him away. But when he didn't move, that his brother walked toward him. And that's when the stranger floated toward the brown object. But my brother, he mm-hmm. said, chased after him. And, I said, well, what happened? And he said, well, at first we were both paralyzed and we couldn't move. Now, mm-hmm. I've heard that repeatedly about being paralyzed.
Right.
And he said then the next day that the both of them were too weak to get out of bed
mm-hmm.
and that they vomited and couldn't eat. And he said
yeah.
my brother was very bad because said he had a rash on his face and neck, and it stayed mm-hmm. there for several days until the local healer came by and made a potion and fixed it.
Mm-hmm.
That's an example of radiation poisoning, which we've also heard in UFO literature. So,
what's interesting is that the UFO. I mean, I don't know why, but for some reason, the UFO didn't know they were there, and so maybe they didn't protect them from that radiation.
Right.
You know, maybe the radiation occurs around the ship, obviously, because, you know, the studies that have been done of landing sites are that there's radiation on the landing site. So, obviously, radiation, at least with some of the UFOs, is part of their propulsion, you know, of the ship. So, But they evidently protect the people from it in most cases because, you know, the actual abductions that occur out of homes and everything, they don't get radiation poisoning.
Well, and they were right under where that ship, you know, was hovering.
Right, yeah. And the, Right, yeah. So it must be interesting why that ship didn't know they were there. You know, I guess they didn't check, you know, because obviously they would be able to, they probably have the technology to determine that people are down there.
Well, I think they were interested in that cornfield. And since
they
saw no one in that cornfield, they didn't even think that the brothers were under that tree packing up to go home. You know,
they
were going to go home and eat. And then they witnessed this creature coming out of the, and then his brother struggles with him, you know.
Right,
and he was the one that got the sickest because he was under. Yeah.
He was nearest to it, yeah. Well, would you like to share some of the other stories with our listening audience, some of the ones that you feel are most interesting or pertinent?
I guess the one that sticks out so much in my mind is the story that was told to me by Luis Santiago. He was an elder I met in Copan, and he was he told me that he had worked at the site for 75 years and that in 2 days he would be 100 years old. And he said that he went to work at the site when he was 5 years old, when a man by the name of Spenden came to search the city. Now, Spenden was assistant curator of the the National Museum of Anthropology in New York City. And he said that he was a kind of a runner for Spenden. He would run and get water, and he would run and bring their meat, their lunches, and he would do whatever Spenden wanted him to do. He just ran all over. And he said one day Spenden told him if he would learn English, he would give him a raise. And he said he was true to his word. When he said, by the time I was 8, I was speaking pretty good English, and he gave me 25 cents a day. And he said that when he left, the scientists from Carnegie University came in, and that they were so surprised to find me that I could speak English that they paid me 50 cents, he said.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that on the weekends they would go into the mountains, he and his cousins, and they would search for artifacts, because if they found some good artifacts, the archaeologists would buy them from them.
Right.
And he said on this one particular weekend, they found a silver suit with a skeleton inside. He said it was about a meter long, which would make it about 3 feet.
Mm-hmm.
He said that the little suit was silver from the top of its head to the bottom of its feet.
Mm-hmm.
And that I asked him, well, can you describe it? And he said it was like a coffee can. He said, imagine a coffee can turned upside down. That's what his head covering was like. And he had a hose that came out of it and went into his chest. And there were several buttons on it, he said. And he said he had heard stories about the little people that came from the sky in silver discs that spit fire. And they lived in the mountains sometimes for months at a time. And the people would see them, and they never did anything to us, and we never did anything to them. And he said, I think I've found one of those. I think we found, he said he probably died and was either put in the cave or died in the cave, and we found him. And he said then what they did is they carried him back to the archaeologist, who got very excited when they saw him. And he said he heard one of the scientists say that they should ship him back to the university immediately. Mm-hmm. And he said that that made him very concerned that they would never see the Silver Man again. And he said, I said, well, did you? And he said, no. He said, I saw a box. And I'm sure they shipped him back. Mm-hmm. And he said, your scientists probably know about the truth, that there are people from other planets. And he said, I have regretted what I did. From that day, I have been haunted by what I've done. And he said, I'll never forgive myself for giving away that little man from the stars. And it was a part of our history. It was proof that aliens do exist.
I know, but I bet that had he kept it and it become known that it was in existence, it would have disappeared.
Well, it certainly disappeared this time, didn't it?
Well, it would have disappeared in any case because physical evidence like that is not allowed to be put on public display.
But he was probably one of my most memorable characters because, just in speaking with him, I could see how troubled he had been over the years. I mean, his anguish showed when he was talking to me about what had happened when he was a boy.
Yeah. Well, that's true. So in the book, there's the theory that the Mayan themselves are actually descendants from the star people. Do you want to discuss that theory?
Well, one of the things that's always fascinated me is the idea that aliens came down and enslaved the Mayans or forced the Mayans or whatever to build these cities, but they were the brains behind it. Or the aliens themselves built the cities and then went back to the stars, which doesn't make sense either. And so I asked a number of Mayan scholars and researchers and professors and people I met, what do you think of the ancient astronaut theory? And most of them laugh. And some of the elders said, well, they never ask us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of sums it up. About 50% of the people I talked to believe they were, the Mayans were the ancient astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
That they came to this world with their knowledge. They didn't learn it on Earth. They brought it with them. They built the cities, and at some point or other, the cities could no longer be sustained, whether it was from an earthquake, a hurricane. Scientists now are saying, I just read an article about a month ago that said they're almost 100% sure it was a 100-year drought that caused the abandonment of the ancient cities. And that would make sense because if that whole region was in a drought, that would carried up into New Mexico where the Anasazi were, because scientists say they abandoned that region because there was no water, the drought, a drought impacted them.
Right.
So that would make sense. But, yes, many of the people told me, we brought our knowledge with us. Cortez, we didn't believe that Cortez was a god. We had no white god that was going to come back. Because we had our religion. We brought it with us. And we had our knowledge. We brought that with us too. And we
are the Mayan calendar
built.
Is well known to be very different than anything else in existence.
Yes.
In the indigenous communities. So,
absolutely.
I mean, all indigenous groups have stories about sky people, which is interesting. But the actual Mayan calendar is quite unique. So there were some predictions made about the age that we're in, you know, going in from the fourth to the fifth world. Would you like to speak about that for a minute, in terms of what some of the people were told by the aliens about the coming age?
Well, you know, the native people, as a rule, have a different, indigenous people have a different worldview than the Western worldview. And that worldview, the Western worldview is basically linear, where the worldview of the indigenous people is circular. You begin life and you travel this circle and you come back to a spot where you die, and then someone else is born and life continues. Well, they look at the calendar in the very same way, that an age begins and you travel along this path, and eventually that age ends and a new age begins. And so when all of this furor over the December 21st was going on, the Maya themselves, some were entrepreneurs and took advantage of it and let the tourists do whatever. Others were just kind of stood back and were amused by the whole thing. You know, I mean, you could go to Palenque and you probably be stopped by a guy, by a vendor who will ask you if you want to see their ancient astronaut. It's a bastardization of the culture, but that's what they do to make money. And many tourists are caught up in this kind of thing and are, you know, put out dollars for their ancient astronaut. But they believe that what happened is that one world ended and a new one has begun, and this one is going to be rocked with turmoil for the next several years, and perhaps it'll be another 20 years before things settle down and human beings actually will reach a higher level of consciousness and peace will reign again upon Earth, but that we'll have to go through this in order to survive, you know, the new world that's coming.
Yeah, I think that sums it up. So we are in kind of a rocky area right now, although we're not sure exactly the cause of that.
No, they gave no reason for it. Almost like it was fate, that it was predetermined that this was going to happen. You know, that moving from one period to another.
Yeah, there's some that believe that the approach of Planet X into our solar system and coming close to Earth is what causes these cataclysms every cycle or so. But they don't make mention of that. That's interesting. As sky people, they should know about it, though.
Yeah, I had no mention of that whatsoever.
Right. Well.
Well, and I think that some of the African tribes talk about that. The Dogons, don't they talk about that?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do. But, that's true.
And I don't know about the Aborigines of Australia. You know, I haven't been able to spend much time with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got I've interviewed one author on her husband's journey with the Aborigines of Australia in terms of the healing abilities that he was able to get and some of their cultures, but I don't recall much about prophecy. But
I'm not sure that they have that, you know.
Yeah.
But certainly in this country, we have the Hopi who have for all sorts of things that are, you know, going to be happening. So,
yeah, they have a countdown of things, I believe. in order that things occur in. Right. Right. Well, would you like to give your contact information?
Yes. You know, people can go to www.sixkiller.com, and that's my webpage. It's currently being revised and a lot of things added to it. And they can write me at ardy@sixkiller.com. Always welcome comments and questions, and people send me their stories, and people who've read my book like to sometimes talk about it. So feel free to write me, and want to thank all of you who are out there in the listening audience. That's wonderful that you're there.
Well, I think we can learn a lot from all of the indigenous cultures, especially when you start to realize that a lot of the stories of sky people are very similar, you know, and yet the indigenous populations were separated geographically fairly well. You know, they didn't intermingle very much. And that was, that's one
of
my
interests. Well, a lot of the reservations are in such remote areas. You know, I mean, people in the cities take for granted all of these things that, people don't have, you know, even in Montana in this day and age. I mean, there are a lot of areas that do not have the internet. There are a lot of areas in Montana where you know, you don't get cable television. People are still using antennas. I have a home in Montana where I can't get cell phones. I can't use cell phones. You know, and people take for granted that everybody has their, you know, access all of this information or all of these space-age technology, and that's just not true. And particularly, I think you'll find a lot of the Indian reservations are in extremely isolated areas. So you are dealing with population that, you know, it is not inundated with all of this stuff that's on TV. You know, and satellite TV might be available to them, but it's so expensive that most people can't afford it, you know. So
you
just don't see it.
I wanted to end on a note, bringing up a point that one of the stories talks about. You met him when he was elderly, but he had been abducted many, many times over the years. I think beginning when he was about 6, and he actually was teaching other beings about what he knew, farming and whatever. And so here's the idea that the aliens are actually using the knowledge of the indigenous people, especially the experts, to help educate others about natural, you know, plants and farming and things that might not be able to be taught any other way.
Yes, and that was, they told him that for the purposes that they were literally populating another planet, and they were making a clone of him, actually, long before cloning was even known, you know, in American, you know, to the American population. They had cloned him and had started that process when he was 3 years old. And they told him that his clone would be, go to another planet and would be part of a population, effort there, and that he would carry out the duties of a farmer. So they had chosen his life and his survival ability, you know, to teach another. So it was a really interesting, story, and I found him to be a very credible individual.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when you think about the scope of some of these projects, you know, that if indeed the certain groups have lost their ability to survive on their own planets and have been forced off the planet and maybe including information obtained from abductions or even reproducing with humans to increase survival of their species.
Well, and there's some indication that, at least there seems to me to be indication that there are those out there who've become more mechanical than they are biological, and
right,
sense of characteristics of ability to feel any emotions, and
yeah,
have told their human abductees that their experiences hopefully will lead them back to that.
Because
they're
lack
more
of compassion, right?
Right,
right. Yeah. Well, there's certainly a lot of different experiences. I mean, not all extraterrestrials are the same. There's a wide range of different experiences that the people report.
Well, and I did that on purpose because I collected about 100 interviews, but I wanted the readers to see that there's such a wide range of different kinds of encounters, and I wanted them to know that all of the different types of encounters that are happening around the world are even happening in this region that is so cut off in many aspects from the rest of the world in terms of technology and opportunities and progress.
Right.
They're still living the way they did thousands of years ago in many of these villages.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they are having the same kind of experiences as a doctor in New York might be having, or, you know, an executive in Atlanta might be having. But they're having those, and so that's the reason why I tried to put in a variety of stories. There's different aliens, there's different kinds of ships,
right,
different experiences. And I wanted the reader to see that even though they don't have the knowledge about UFO encounters that we have in this part of the country, this part of the world, that they're having the same kind of experiences.
Right, right. Well, I think that's important. Well, thank you so much for joining us today to share your book.
It's my pleasure.
We've been interviewing Dr. Artie Clark. Her book, Sky People, Untold Stories of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica, and her earlier book, Similar Stories About Native American Encounters. A great read for people who are interested in UFO and extraterrestrial knowledge. Anyway, thanks a lot, Dr. Clark, and we look forward to any other books that you might write. Please let us know, and we'll have you back on the show.
Sounds great. Have a good day.
All righty. You too. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week for Natural Remedies for Inflammation, Dr. Christopher Vasey. And the week after that, John Ryan, The Missing Pill, The Rise of Energy-Based Healing and Consciousness Biospiritual Transformation. Thanks a lot for joining us. Please join us next week.